From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Left, Right, and Center presents 1 year later.
1 year later.
Can you believe it's 1 year later?
1 year later.
1 year later.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Hi, I'm Jamil Smith, your host today for the special series 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. It's the Trump era, and we're taking a new approach to political debate. Today, firearms have long been a part of the conservative brand.
In the showroom on our walls, we have a lot of different t-shirts. Our most popular t-shirt is "Buy a Gun, Annoy a Liberal."
Social science researchers have found that support for gun rights is strongest among white people who are racially prejudiced. However, since Donald Trump's election, it's Black Americans who feel the need to protect themselves. But does everyone have the same Second Amendment rights? That's coming up on 1 year later, after headlines from NPR.
Check out KCRW's All News channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
This is 1 year later, and I'm your host, Jamil Smith. Today, we go to Texas.
Is that a 308 or?
This one, yes.
Yeah.
This is a 308.
The man you can hear showing a rifle to a customer is Michael Cargill. He is
the only African-American gun store owner in the entire state of Texas. It's sad. I wish we had more. I think we need more. Yeah. And we will, because more guns will equal less crime.
Cargill knows people might think he's a bit of an outlier, politically speaking.
I'm that person where you can't fit me into a box, you know, so I don't fit on the left, I don't fit in the right, but, you know, I do vote and lean conservative, I'm a Republican, but it's really hard to fit me in that box because I'm also in a same-sex relationship where I've had the same partner for over, you know, 20 years.
But for him, the Second Amendment means more than anything. He told us why.
I grew up in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and I actually went into the military, went to the military for 12 years. After getting out of the military, I actually started working for a telecommunications company, and then after that, I went into a trucking company where I owned the trucking company, and I actually moved elevators around the country, and then I got into the Second Amendment. The reason I got into the Second Amendment is because that my grandmother decided that at 70 years old, she was going to go to college to get a college degree. My grandmother only had a high school education. So at 70, she decided she wanted to become a nurse, so she went to college. While she was traveling from a college library, sitting at a bus stop waiting for a bus to come, a guy came along, mugged her, and raped her. So I decided at that point I would make sure that every family member and everyone in my family had the tools they need to protect themselves. So that's why I started teaching the handgun license courses. That's why I opened the gun store, and we've been here for almost 7 years, and because I wanted them to be comfortable with purchasing a gun, and also getting the training. We don't carry a gun because we want to shoot someone. You know, we carry one because, you know, it's for our personal protection, because we want to survive and go home that day.
We'll hear more from Michael Cargill later in the program, but now I want to introduce Alexandra Falindra. She's a professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Welcome to 1 year later, Alexandra.
Thank you for having me.
I grew up with guns in the house, Alexandra, and my father trained me to use them safely and responsibly, but not because we were afraid of bigots enabled by the President of the United States. What forces collectively are driving this increase since the election in gun purchases by marginalized groups?
Well, you said it. They're marginalized. They feel politically disempowered. And this is a way to emotionally reassure themselves. I grew up in a family of hunters, too. So my father had a hunting rifle. For a lot of people, these tools of the trade, which used to be used for hunting and used to be a lot about people in the military would be trained to use them, they have become, in the past several decades, a political statement, a way to express an identity. Mm-hmm. When people feel more or less powerful or powerless when they feel that in relative terms, their position socially and politically is declining.
Mm-hmm.
They turn to guns in this society as a way to basically reassure themselves and to show their power. So guns are about political power in many ways.
So your research has also shown that racial prejudice helps drive opposition to gun control. How did you examine that?
We did several things. First of all, we had we did nationally representative surveys, and we examined existing national data from the American National Election Survey and other sources of data. And when we look at the correlation between attitudes towards African Americans, and this is among whites again, attitudes among African Americans tend to correlate strongly with opposition to gun control among whites, even when you're controlling for people's ideology and partisanship and economic status,
mm-hmm.
and other things that we know drive political attitudes and issue attitudes.
Got you. I want to play another part from our interview with Michael Cargill, the gun store owner in Texas, where he's referring to what he saw in his shop after the 2016 election.
There have been a lot of people in the LGBTQ community that have come in because they wanted to get the training. They wanted to buy a gun. They wanted to get all the training that comes along with it. And this group is actually a little different than when Obama was in office. And Obama was in office, it was more about, you know, I want to get this before it's banned. But now this is about people want to get the training. They want to learn about the gun. They want to get a, take a class from the beginning and then get their license and be legal with it. So it's a different feel, different reaction with this current president. I'm actually a member of the African American Gun Club, where we've seen a lot of new people to the group. They want to do the same thing. They want to actually walk into the gun store. They want you to tell them about a bunch of different types of guns, and then they make an informed decision. They may even research it online, then come back, you know, make the purchase, take a class. It's totally a different feel than what it's been for the last 8 years. Probably because some people are afraid of the things that are being spouted up around this president, that, you know, maybe there's some racial tension or something like that that's been brought up, not necessarily with the president, but the people that are around the president or in support of the president, and they see some things that are happening and they want to take their own personal protection in their own hands.
Alexandra, what do you make of what he says there? You're saying that there's clear data showing that there are fewer guns in minority communities, and yet we've been hearing that since the 2016 election, more African Americans and also LGBTQ Americans are purchasing guns.
It's true that there has been anecdotally a spike in firearms purchases among marginalized groups, minorities and racial minorities and also gender minorities. I know that there was a big story here in Chicago, where I am, about African-American women in the south side of Chicago wanting to buy firearms and get trained and so to have it as protection. It is very difficult to quantify that trend because the data is not there. We don't have unified data that can allow us to know how many exact people are buying and who they are, because the national system of background checks and also any kind of licensing and registration is not a unified national system. We don't have demographic data on all of that. So all we know comes from surveys, and with smaller populations, you can't really pick up just from surveys an uptick in whether they're buying guns in large numbers or not. People seem to be expressing, as a reason of for buying a gun, a need for greater safety. But what we're seeing in our data is that actually people who feel unsafe in terms of crime are far more likely to support gun control than support gun rights.
Hmm.
So people who are realistically afraid to walk around their neighborhood, people who say that crime is going up and that's a bad thing because I feel unsafe, those people are far more likely to also tell us we should get guns off the streets. We should have stricter gun regulations. Not so many people should have guns. We shouldn't have so many guns in civilian hands.
Mm-hmm.
And also the data from public health experts also suggest very clearly that there is a strong correlation between the proliferation of firearms in the civilian population and the increase in the number of shootings and suicides and homicides and accidents, because the reality of it is, even if you get trained, you will never get the level of training and exposure that a military officer or police officer gets.
Right.
And even there, look at how often you have police officers who are trained, who keep being trained.
I was just about to say.
Yeah. And they shoot the wrong person, and they shoot unarmed people, and, you know, they make mistakes. If I, with 10 hours of shooting training, carry a gun in my purse, I am far more likely of making a mistake out of fear, out of like being in a situation that I'm surprised and anxious, or to have my child or somebody else by mistake take the gun and shoot a human being or shoot me.
Mm-hmm. Right. And in that light, I want to actually explore something a little bit, you know, related to that. I mean, you live in Chicago, an entire city that this president essentially uses as an example of where gun control goes wrong. And whether or not that's, you know, true, certainly, you know, up for conversation. But there's an undeniable racial element to that. And I want to hear once again from Michael Cargill about that particular issue.
For the African American Gun Club, it's more online presence than it is actually physically doing anything. A lot of people share some of the different things they do. It's a place that you can actually go and talk to other African Americans, you know, about gun issues and gun problems, and not worried about someone thinking that you're a criminal, because that's how we're, you know, portrayed sometimes in the media as being the bad guy with the gun. So with the African American Gun Club, which we're all law-abiding citizens, you know, it's a good place to sit and talk with like-minded other African Americans.
Alexandra, how does the racial element of this relate to your research? The fact that African Americans with guns are perceived as criminals or perceived as a threat?
Oh, absolutely. And that is a key problem that goes actually back to colonial America. African Americans have, for whites, in the white imagination and in the way whites perceive them, as more violent.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very strong presumption of violence among African Americans. And it is not necessarily conscious. It's not that people express these beliefs of old-style racism consciously, but
mm-hmm.
it is subconscious, and it's strong in there. And we know this because psychologists have done experiments, which are called first-shooter game experiments, where basically they put you in a video game, and you are put in these ambiguous situations where you need to shoot at somebody, and you're supposed to shoot at the person who's threatening because they have a gun. But it's far more likely mm-hmm. to perceive the African-American character as having a gun than other people as having a gun.
Right.
So there is a higher likelihood of misperceiving an African-American as being violent. There is also experiments that show that in dark ambient light, when you're in a dark room, you may actually associate even that, the environment, with black violence. So these connections between African-Americans and violence are very strong undercurrents. So for African-Americans to be going around with firearms, especially with open carry and open carry states. They are actually putting themselves in danger because people may very well mistake them mm-hmm. for dangerous individuals.
Yeah.
That's exactly what this proprietor was saying, that this presumption increases and you may want to have the firearm for self-protection, but you may actually end up putting yourself in peril because you're not perceived as a safe, law-abiding citizen.
Mm-hmm.
An African-American man with a gun is not perceived as a citizen soldier.
Right.
He's perceived essentially as somebody who is dangerous.
Right. And that goes for women as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It seems like we're really not going to be able to confront this issue of gun control or gun rights until the race issue is dealt with, or at least it's until it's factored into the solution.
Absolutely. And basically, having accessibility to guns doesn't seem to be a good idea for anyone. This is not necessarily the way to improve collective security or individual security.
Alexandra Fillinger, Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Chicago. I appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
Oh, sure.
Listeners, if you want to chime in on this topic and others, go to our webpage, kcrw.com/oneyearlater. And know that One Year Later is also available as a podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your audio on demand. Please subscribe, please spread the word, and please leave us a review. We'll take a brief break. Stay tuned to listen to a phone call between two listeners of ours, one a Trump supporter, one a registered Democrat, talking about guns. This is One Year Later from PRI. Welcome back to One Year Later. I'm your host, Jamil Smith. We're discussing guns and the Second Amendment in the Trump era. Recently, we asked you, our listeners, whether you'd be willing to discuss one of the pressing issues of this political moment with someone who has an opposing point of view. We got plenty of takers, and we decided to match up people for civil conversations. Here's one of them. It's a phone call between a Trump supporter and a registered Democrat discussing guns.
My name is Ellie Bontrager. I live in Lyman, Colorado, which is 80 miles east of Denver. No mountains here. We've got wind, wheat, cattle, and blizzards. I stayed home for 35 years with my children. Now I work for the USPS. And although the headlines are horrifying, and every time there's another shooting, I'm grieving for those people, I still believe that our Second Amendment rights should not be infringed, that all Americans should have the right to carry a gun, within reason.
My name is Charles Swinford. I'm a graphic designer in Maryland. I come from a military family. My feelings on guns are less about the guns themselves than the society that we live in and how we react to them. So while I agree that our rights are important, I also believe that there is some problem, something wrong with the way that we fail to react, fail to take action, to do anything about the violence in our society, and specifically around guns.
I agree that there is something wrong in our society, absolutely. There's just crazy people out there that just go off the deep end or something and get a weapon and shoot people. And it's terrible. And I feel very, very badly for the victims of these shootings. But I don't think gun control is the answer because it's just more government intrusion into our lives. I think the answer is love and getting back to Judeo-Christian values and
punishing the criminals and not coddling them.
I generally agree with that. But what I see in the way that we actually react to these horribly common events is that we scream at each other, either take away all the guns or no, we need to put guns everywhere to make it safe.
Right.
And yeah, and it's it's like, wait, can't we just sit down like adults and take some real action, not some small, well, let's ban this one particular type of trigger. It's like, well, that's not going to do anything. Let's figure out what might actually make a difference. When you have a problem, you can't fix it if you don't start somewhere.
Right. Discussing the causes just violence in general? Is that one thing?
And I mean, it would be a start.
Right. On another tangent, the media, although, of course, these events should be reported, I just feel like maybe if they could just bring it down a notch or two because of copycat. You know, not that I would say that we censor it.
I don't know if it's the media. I think it boils down to us as individuals, because we crave it. You got it. Oh, what's the new horrible thing?
Yes, the media feeds our hunger.
Like they're us. They're us. So I don't think they're the problem. I think what you described is a symptom of something bigger.
A symptom of maybe just the human nature of, well, just being interested in somebody's tragedy.
I'm joined now by Adam Winkler. He's a constitutional law professor at UCLA, where he focuses on the Second Amendment and gun control. Thank you for joining us, Adam.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about what we just heard. Ellie and Charles have opposite views on gun control, clearly, but it seems they agree on some big things. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think there is a lot of agreement on many issues when it comes to guns. It's almost as if there's just such a divorce between the public and our elected officials. I think there's if you look at polling data, it shows that most Americans support the idea that individuals have a right to bear arms, that they believe the Second Amendment does protect an individual right. At the same time, most people believe there's plenty of room for gun control within the confines of the Second Amendment. And things like universal background checks get very, very high support when you do polls. Part of the problem is that we have a real diversity in terms of intensity. And people who support gun control support it, but they're not single-issue pro-gun control voters. On the gun rights side, there's a much more intensity, and the people who are really strongly pro-gun make this a very important issue for them come election day.
Mm-hmm.
And that really leads to big differences in how our elected officials approach these issues.
Ellie brought up media coverage of the shootings. How much does that contribute to the gun control conversation, or lack thereof?
Well, look, the media is always there identifying these issues. The media can blow things out of proportion, as we know, but also can get America focused on issues that otherwise that we wouldn't pay attention to. And, you know, when we think about media attention, what we should notice is that, the media brings a lot of attention to things like mass shootings, but perhaps doesn't bring enough attention to other forms of gun violence, such as ordinary criminal gun violence or suicide, which makes up over half the gun deaths every year are suicide, but we don't hear at all about that as part of our gun problem. So the media certainly affects how we see some things, sometimes in good ways and sometimes in bad ways.
All right, let's listen to the second part of Charles and Ellie's conversation. Ellie starts by talking about how difficult it can be to start talking about gun control in the wake of a shooting.
So I talked with my 25-year-old daughter, who, of course, was also horrified by the shootings, and said, we just have to get guns away from mentally ill people. And I said, but Meg, who's going to decide who's mentally ill? That is a huge issue, to have the government stepping in and saying, okay, we have decided that you cannot own a gun. And that's the give them an inch, they'll take a mile. Now, I can certainly see if someone has been charged with a crime of domestic violence or is a felon, that's one thing. But when you're applying to own a gun, when you're doing the background check. You know, at this point, there's no checking for mental illness because there's nobody's willing to say this person is mentally ill. It's only after the fact, sadly.
And I actually fully understand that hesitation in some people, just because there's already enough stigma that goes along with mental illness that people are unwilling to go get the help that they need.
Yes.
I can think of people that I'm close to that have served, that have done, you know, a tour of duty, and they come back, and a couple of them, thankfully, you know, they wanted to talk to somebody, and that was very good, and the people around them supported them, but not everyone is that lucky. And you hear tragedies of where someone has gone through something, and you find out after the fact that they've gone through this horrible thing, and it festered inside them.
Right. Are you speaking of like PTSD from combat?
My specific reaction that I'm thinking of is exactly that, but it doesn't have to be from that. It could be
like it could be just PTSD from a sexual assault that
exactly
you lived through, but you're damaged.
And I don't want to take any rights away from anyone that's gone through that. And I don't, they certainly don't deserve any punishments as a result of that. But on the other hand, it seems like most people can agree that there's a line you have to draw somewhere. If someone is proven to be violent.
Yes. But even if we do get stricter gun laws and restrict the rights of, quote, mentally ill, people can still get guns illegally.
Yeah.
And then
yeah, and
they're back to square one.
And when it comes to the just the sheer number of guns that are out in this country, it's like that. Those horses have left the barn. Like we,
right?
We've got a lot of guns in this country, and if you want one, you can. If you try hard enough, you can get one.
Yes.
So again, at least, like when I hear these news reports, I'm saddened but also frustrated because part of me thinks, how long is it going to be until we hear another one?
Right.
And what are we going to do between then and now? What makes me so frustrated is that the answer I keep coming back to is nothing. We're going to talk about how sad it is, and then we're not going to do anything. And I'm to the point that it's like, let's just try something.
Yes.
And somewhere, we got to start somewhere.
Yes, I agree.
I want to see the two sides of this debate because it seems that the people that are willing to talk about it seem to be in a general agreement that that we need to do something. And I want to see two things. I want to see people, and not just politicians and not just lobbyists and industry people. I want to see like everyday people that are willing to just talk about the problem and acknowledge that there is one and that we need to do something. And then the second thing that could lead from that is, can we just compromise that the people that, like me, that are for gun control, understand that maybe what they want isn't going to happen. And the people that are for, you know, the Wild West, understand that that can't happen either. And let's just get together and say, okay, let's compromise and come up with some kind of imperfect solution, because what we're doing now is not working.
Very well said, Charles.
May we all have such civil conversations about gun rights and gun control. Adam, I'm thinking about what they brought up there, which is the instinctive reactions, particularly those who, you know, politically speaking, are inclined to defend gun rights. People like President Trump coming out after mass shootings and saying that this isn't a gun thing or isn't about guns and that this is purely about mental health. How has that narrative, you know, that's been pushed by the NRA and other gun rights supporters settled into our American consciousness? And what can we do about that?
Well, it turns out that people with mental health problems actually account for a very small percentage of America's gun violence problem. And again, the focus on mass shooting tends to highlight people who are the most disturbed, but not the people who are causing the most violence and disturbing us so much. Part of the problem with the mental health frame is not only that it targets only a fraction of the real gun violence problem that we have in America, but it's also especially debilitating a frame because it is hard to figure out who's mentally ill and take guns away from that person before they've done harm. There's no easy way to figure out exactly who's mentally ill. We don't subject people to mental health testing, and we're not going to require people who go seek counseling to have that fact reported against them, because that will discourage people from getting counseling. So we have difficulty trying to, once we've said the problem is mental illness, and then we recognize, oh, well, it's almost impossible to identify who's mentally ill in advance, well, then we've set ourselves up to lose because we can't now do anything to really solve that problem as we've defined it.
Speaking of imperfect solutions, as Charles mentioned, Republicans talk a lot about repeal and replace when they discuss Obamacare. Do we need to instead repeal and replace the Second Amendment with something that fits our current technological and sociological realities?
I think there are some people who would like to see that happen, but I think that's based on a misunderstanding of the Second Amendment and its consequences. You know, the Second Amendment, as it's enforced in the courts of law today, is not a significant barrier to good and effective gun control laws. The Supreme Court has only said you have a right to have a handgun in your home for self-defense. That's an issue that, whether the Supreme Court says it or not, people are still going to have handguns in their homes for self-defense. There's 320 million guns out there. The courts have upheld the vast majority of gun control laws. The real problem facing gun control advocates today is in legislators. Legislatures have proven hostile to gun control, and they haven't been able to get good gun laws passed. And so repealing the Second Amendment won't solve America's gun problem. It's a political problem, not a constitutional one.
Mm-hmm. Thank you to Adam Winkler, constitutional law professor at UCLA. Appreciate you joining us on 1 Year Later.
Pleasure.
When we come back on our Talk It Out segment, the Harvey Weinstein and Roy Moore allegations have led to some reckoning among liberals about Bill Clinton. And that was before today's news about Senator Al Franken. That's when we continue with 1 Year Later from Public Radio International. I'm Jamil Smith, back with 1 Year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. This is the part of the show where we talk it out, when we talk through the big political stories of the day with two political viewpoints. I'll do my best to hold up the liberal end of this conversation with Catherine Mangu Ward. She's the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine and our libertarian voice today. Catherine, welcome to 1 Year Later.
Thank you for having me.
The Harvey Weinstein and Roy Moore allegations have prompted some public reckonings from liberals lately about Bill Clinton's behavior during the Monica Lewinsky scandal and beforehand. Of course, there are many other women that have a string of accusations against him. Michelle Goldberg of The New York Times wrote definitively, "I believe Juanita," meaning Juanita Broderick, who alleged that Bill Clinton raped her in 1978. For the record, I do as well. And Matthew Iglesias of Vox argued yesterday that Clinton should have resigned over Lewinsky and that he and liberals who, quote, regarded the whole sordid matter as primarily the fault of congressional Republicans, excessive scandal mongering, were wrong. This all seems a bit late, but what's your take on this?
I think that partisan politics have a way of blinding people. People have been willfully blind to the failings of the powerful men in their own parties. This is systematic. It's ongoing. As a libertarian, I am perfectly happy to chuck Bill Clinton's legacy down the well behind Roy Moore. That is fine by me. And Al Franken can follow them down for all I care. I think that, you know, it's quite easy to treat people as means and not ends in themselves. And that's what we do when we say, okay, maybe they're not perfect, but they'll vote the right way on abortion. Maybe they're not perfect, but they'll vote the right way on the Supreme Court. And I think it's really important to separate, I like this guy's politics from, I think that his behavior toward women is appropriate or inappropriate, and mm-hmm. we're terrible at that.
Right.
And that's something that this latest round has highlighted. You know, Matt Iglesias is welcome to join the party, but it's a little too late.
The latest allegations today against Senator Al Franken of Minnesota come from television host and radio broadcaster Leanne Tweeden, who says that Franken, while he was still a comedian, groped her while she was asleep on a military plane during a 2006 USO tour. And there's a photo of it, by the way. And he also assaulted her, kissing her forcefully without her permission. Here was Tweeden in a press conference today talking about the alleged forced kissing during a rehearsal for the USO performance.
Al, this isn't SNL. We're not really going to kiss, so we don't really have to practice. And he just kept persisting, and it just reminded me of, like, the Harvey Weinstein tape that you heard the girl when she was wired up for the New York, the NYPD, and he just persistent and badgering and just relentless, you know? And so I was just like, okay, fine, just so he would shut up, you know? And he just sort of came at me, and we did the line, and he came at me, and before you even know it, I mean, you kind of get close, and he just put his hand on the back of my head, and he mashed his face against, I mean, it happened so fast, and he just mashed his lips against my face, and he stuck his tongue in my mouth so fast. And all I can remember is that his lips were really wet, and it was slimy.
He apologized in a lengthy written statement and said that he would cooperate in an ethics investigation, but I know that there are folks like me who feel that Senator Franken probably should just resign and make sure that they open up a spot for someone who hasn't done these kinds of things. What are your thoughts on the story?
So I do think there's a flip side to the blindness in which we excuse politicians we like, which is that we're quick to condemn politicians we don't. And, you know, I certainly have lots of reasons to oppose Roy Moore and Al Franken, for that matter, in terms of their legislative and judicial records. You know, I do think it's important from a legal perspective that that due process is honored, that we sort of take seriously the counterclaims when these men make them. But in many cases, we're seeing, as in Franken's case, relatively rapid admission of some level of guilt, at which point I do think it's appropriate for the kind of social and cultural and, you know, party level mechanism to kick in and say, yeah, maybe it's time to resign.
Right. And that's kind of where I stand on this. I feel like he is pretty much admitted that he did this, whether or not he's remembering it the same way. He acknowledges that something went wrong and that she was injured by this, you know, whether emotionally or physically. And, you know, as such, why then should he stay? Why should the party then, you know, rely upon him to, A, not repeat that behavior, but also to follow up and with a legacy that you know, somehow they want to honor, you know, they would be proud of. This is always going to be a mark on his record, as with Bill Clinton.
Congress's approval ratings are incredibly low and have been for a very long time now. I think if, as an institution, they want to restore people's trust, this is not a great way to start.
Right.
You know, and I think more than that, one thing that I've actually found fascinating about the kind of Me Too phenomenon, you know, 2017 generally, is the fact that it's happening entirely on a cultural level, right? This is not an instance where we changed the law and women came forward, or even where official censure is typically the mechanism that's bringing about change. It's just a collective societal decision not to put up with certain behavior, and then individual women coming forward and saying, "This happened to me." It's an act of bravery by those women. It's made more powerful by the numbers that we're seeing. And I think it is not surprising to me that this happened last on the Hill. That, you know, we've moved through industries and industry practices have changed. But the more opaque and in some ways, I think the more regulated, protected sort of monopoly an industry is, the more likely they were to hope to stay outside of this phenomenon. But Hollywood falls and then Washington.
Right. But in that light, I want to go back to your note about due process. I mean, this is not a court of law. This is a culture. This is a sort of the court of public opinion, as it were. And so, you know, are politicians being held to the same account that, say, Harvey Weinstein or Kevin Spacey or any of the other publicly outed offenders are? I mean, there's no way to necessarily fire Al Franken or Roy Moore. You know, there's no way to even get Roy Moore out of the race necessarily unless he's willing.
Right. I mean, with politicians, the comeuppance can take a little bit longer to kick in, right? But even if we can't wind up in a situation where Al Franken or Roy Moore is out immediately, the way you could in an at-will or contractual or an employment situation. You know, it is still true that in 2 years or 6 years, the American people will have a chance to weigh in. I am totally sympathetic to the idea that, you know, maybe that's not soon enough, but I actually think it's one reason that these cases took so long to come out is because they are edge cases, because in many cases it is behavior that, you know, to my mind and to many people's minds, doesn't cross all the way into an obvious, you know, call 911 type scenario, doesn't mean we should tolerate it. And I think the fact that it's happening at the level of public discussion, of culture, you know, in our kind of private institutions is probably the right level for it to be handled at, and Congress is going to be a relatively small exception to that.
Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, announced today that there should be an ethics investigation into Franken. So he was essentially agreeing with him. Then you have, of course, Jackie Speier and Robert Comstock coming forth the other day saying that there are two people in, you know, currently serving in Congress who have, you know, committed sexual harassment, what have you. When the electorate was confronted with these allegations regarding Trump in 2016, why do you feel like that was handled so differently, not just by the Republican Party, but by the populace at large?
I think this brings us back to where we started. It's the willful blindness thing. People were willing to put up with a lot for what they thought was a meaningful end. And, you know, this is something that you hear even among kind of intellectual conservatives and even some libertarians here in Washington is essentially, but Gorsuch, right? But Supreme Court picks matter so much that we can tolerate anti-immigration sentiment, that we can tolerate, you know, poor behavior toward women and on a personal level. We can tolerate, you know, there's this sort of weighing in the balance of those allegations. And I think that's I think that is the approach that happens in elections. But I don't think it has to be the only way we think and talk about this. I think we can absolutely completely separate the question of, is this guy going to vote the way I want most of the time? Yes or no?
Mm-hmm.
Has he gone below some, frankly, already quite low bar of appropriate behavior for a human who should be allowed to serve in high office? That's a question we should adjudicate separately, and it shouldn't. We shouldn't put our thumb on the scale just because we like who they pick for the court.
We knew that this whole thing would sweep up members of Congress. We've seen this before. Do you feel like other folks on Capitol Hill are bracing for more revelations?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, you know, just recently the revelations have come out about, I think it's $15 million over the last decade or so that have gone to settlements for Hill staffers, employment violations. You know, I think we're going to see more of that. It's not as if there's something about going into public service that indicates that you were a good person. In fact, some might even argue the opposite. And I think it's absolutely the case that, you know, D.C. is a happy hour town. It's a town where younger people who are just starting out and older people mingle socially. I would be shocked if we don't hear an awful lot more of this type of thing coming out of the halls of Congress in the next 18 months.
Very quickly about Roy Moore. Obviously, there's more accusers that were published their claims, you know, Alabama press. Can you tell me a little bit about what you think is going to happen with that race, or how Republicans are going to get out of this fix?
You know, the technicalities of it are something I'm not an expert in, and I know that the people who are experts are scrambling right now to figure out their options, so I wouldn't presume to pronounce on that. One thing I will say, though, is, you know, this is perhaps a case against early absentee voting. A big structural barrier to removing Moore from the ticket is the fact that, you know, an awful lot of people already made their decision about who they wanted to win in this race before they had this information. And I think we can continue to expect that stuff like this is going to come out.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be a case for pulling back from that early voting. Also, I think, you know, if he does make it to the Hill, I would hope that if Mitch McConnell does, you know, initiate some kind of investigation, that he does it even-handedly across both his colleagues and those across the aisle.
We shall see. Catherine Mangue Ward is the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. Thank you for joining us, Catherine.
Thank you.
That's it for today on 1 Year Later. Meet us back here tomorrow. I'll take you back to my high school, and we'll see how young black men are coping in the age of Trump. You can subscribe to 1 Year Later on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your audio on demand, and leave us a review. 1 Year Later is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.